supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. It was another devastating day for Philadelphia's Jewish community. Not even 48 hours after vandals toppled hundreds of gravestones at the Mount Carmel Cemetery in northeast Philadelphia, a wave of bomb threats hit Jewish community centers across the region. For many, it was a day to literally pick up the pieces as uncertainty loomed. WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Aaron has more from Mount Carmel Jewish Cemetery.
As a news helicopter circled overhead, Mark Levin wove through the tombstones of Mount Carmel Monday afternoon. Like so many canvassing the cemetery, he was looking for a family gravestone. In his case, that of his parents.
It's right around here somewhere.
They came in somber succession, each praying they would find stones still upright and intact. Levin's mother and father both served in World War II. He'd hoped the vandals would see the military insignia on the graves and spare them. They didn't.
God, I was coming here, just hoping that...
As his unfinished thoughts drifted into the breeze, Levin looked down at a double headstone lying flat against the earth.
What can you say? Just ignorant people. Very ignorant people that do things like that.
An administrator with the cemetery counted 150 damaged headstones as of midday Monday. As families assessed the damage, reports rolled in that three Jewish community centers and a school in the Philadelphia region were evacuated due to bomb threats. All of that was top of mind Monday afternoon as a group of faith leaders gathered in Germantown to condemn the acts. Among them was Bill Worley of the United Church of Christ.
It will not, that expression of hate, make America great. But the compassion, the unity, and the community that stands on this stage will.
Police have not yet announced suspects in either the bomb threat or graveyard incidents. There is a $13,000 reward for information leading to the arrest of the Mount Carmel perpetrators. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron, WHYY News.
In addition to the vandalism at the Mount Carmel Jewish Cemetery in northeast Philadelphia, today marks the fifth wave of bomb threats against Jewish community centers and Jewish institutions this year. Joining me with perspective is Nancy Baron-Bear, Regional Director of the Anti-Defamation League. Nancy, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
You are welcome.
How do we quantify and make sense of whether this is an increasing trend, both in our region and, frankly, throughout the country and world?
I'm not sure how we quote-unquote, quantify this, but I can tell you that there is increased fear, there is increased anxiety in the Jewish community and, to be honest, in the other communities surrounding us. There is no question that this combination of the 100 headstones yesterday and the Jewish community centers, five of which were in our region, have indicated to us that we must be extremely mindful and on guard against anti-Semitism.
In the course of reading about increased incidents of anti-Semitism, I've been struck by Martin Luther King's words, apparently in a 1967 speech, quote, "In the end, we will remember not the words of our enemies, but the silence of our friends." Toward that end, how much responsibility falls on, in part, our elected leaders?
Certainly, a large responsibility falls on our elected leaders, both to be an example and to be individuals who don't hesitate to speak out and call things what they are. There are bills and actions before Congress on anti-Semitism that people can urge their elected leaders to support. We certainly have urged them to do so. And the simple act of speaking out takes us a long way.
1 week before the vandalism at Mount Carmel, a Jewish cemetery in St. Louis was similarly attacked. And in response, actually appearing at the National Museum of African American History and Culture, President Trump said, quote, "The anti-Semitic threats targeting our Jewish community and community senators are horrible and are painful and a very sad reminder of the work must still be done to root out hate and prejudice and evil." Was that in and of itself sufficient from the Trump administration?
I think that was a start, and we all have to start someplace. So it took the administration a while to condemn anti-Semitism, but that was a strong statement, and now we need to translate the statement into actions.
To the extent that polls are reliable, a Pew survey out this month indicates that Jews are the most warmly regarded faith group in America, with some 67% approval. To the extent that that's true, does it offer hope that perhaps this is a very small segment of the population in the United States that is out to prove otherwise?
One would hope that, in fact, it is a very small segment of the population. Certainly, we've seen an outpouring of concern and affection from all parts of the country. But that small segment of our population has somehow felt more empowered, more emboldened, and stronger in their commitment to do harm to Jews, to other minorities.
I don't know how appropriate it is to ask you for perspective when these incidents are so fresh, but in your tenure with the ADL, have you seen this level of virulence?
In my time with the Anti-Defamation League, this is the worst that I have seen, with the number of bomb threats targeted at JCCs, which last week were at the number 70, and with the addition today of many, including those in our region, Cherry Hill, Wilmington, Harrisburg, York, Wynwood, there is certainly cause for concern, deep cause for concern. It takes all of us, each one of us, not to be a bystander, but to be an ally, but to be someone who stands up and says, I will not tolerate this.
You're expressing hope that people can come together. In addition, are there actual actions that people concerned can take?
Certainly. On May 21st, we will be holding our 7th annual Walk Against Hate at the Philadelphia Navy Yard. That's the walkagainsthate.org. If there was ever a time for people to come together, it is a large multicultural and diversity festival. People will learn, they will enjoy, they will walk, and they'll do it together with people of all backgrounds.
Nancy Baron Bera, thanks so much for taking time to offer perspective on NewsWorks tonight.
You're most welcome. Thank you for having me.
Nancy Baron Bera is the regional director of the Anti-Defamation League. Amid evolving changes in federal immigration policy, unauthorized immigrants in Philadelphia and other sanctuary cities have been getting a lot of attention. Though, as WHYY's Laura Benchoff reports, Mexican agricultural workers living in southern Chester County also have concerns, which they aired at a recent community meeting.
More than 200 people packed into the waiting area of La Comunidad Hispana in Kennett Square, seeking advice from lawyers, social workers, and the Mexican consulate. The questions were written on note cards, which staff members read aloud to maintain anonymity.
Otra pregunta. I am undocumented and work at a mushroom farm.
Over the course of the hour-long meeting, variations on one question kept coming up. Can you be deported for driving without a license in rural Chester County?
I have been stopped before for running a red light, and the police officer just gave me a ticket, which I paid. What happens now?
Driving without a license is not in itself a crime in Pennsylvania, attorneys told the audience. However, driving under the influence, or in some cases causing an accident, is. While many focused on legal questions, some asked for help talking to their children. One woman says her daughter complains of stomach pains and refuses to go to school.
She is concerned that her father and I will be deported and she will come home and no one will be there. What do I tell her? How can we explain what is happening to our children?
The panel urged honesty and getting the right information about your particular legal status to your family. That advice underpins all of the night's questions and answers, says La Comunidad Hispana's executive director, Elisa Jones.
You have so many people that are afraid and that are stressed, and they didn't know where to start. Now they do. So what's going to happen is people are going to start making a plan.
In addition to unauthorized residents, some people with green cards and representatives from local churches and area mushroom farms were present. Immigration lawyers at the meeting say they are swamped with requests for information sessions and private consultations regarding individual immigration cases. For WHYY, I'm Laura Benshoff.
Pennsylvania has rapidly become a major hub for the development of new natural gas pipelines. In recent weeks, billions of dollars have been approved for projects by state and federal regulators. Shortly after he took office, Governor Tom Wolf convened a large task force to recommend ways to coordinate planning and best practices for this building boom. Though as State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusick reports, one year on, it appears the report has largely been ignored.
The governor's pipeline infrastructure task force had problems from the beginning. For one thing, it was really big, with close to 150 members. For another, they had a pretty hard time agreeing on anything. There were representatives from industry, government, academia, and environmental groups, and they weren't exactly all on the same page. Finally, the public meetings were often disrupted by protesters. At the last meeting, about a year ago, seven people were arrested.
Task force!
The whole effort was spearheaded by then-Secretary of the Department of Environmental Protection, John Quigley. At the group's final meeting, he said the report is just a first step, and the state's work on pipelines should continue.
Again, this is the start of a conversation, and it's fertile ground. I really do honestly believe that this is a very fertile document that can generate a lot of positives.
Among the report's 184 recommendations were calls to do things like increase public participation and planning, beef up pipeline safety requirements, and coordinate permitting. Senator Andy Dinneman, a Democrat from Chester County, spoke up and said he was disappointed. He didn't think anyone in the legislature had even heard of it.
Much of this is going to require legislative action.
If the pipeline task force is to have any relevance, Dinneman said, the report should be shared widely with the legislature.
Otherwise, it gets put, like all task force reports, gets put on a shelf somewhere.
A few months later, Quigley lost his job, and with his departure, it appears much of the work stopped. Dan Devlin hasn't talked to anyone about it in about a year. He heads the Bureau of Forestry at the Department of Conservation and Natural Resources, and he was on the task force.
I haven't personally followed up either. I probably should have as well.
His agency is still doing things it was already doing, like trying to co-locate pipelines with existing right-of-ways and monitoring for the threat of invasive species. But he praises the task force for giving him a chance to meet a lot of people from diverse backgrounds.
I think that was one of the big things, is that we all kind of got to see what each other was doing and, kind of learn from each other.
So what have other agencies done with the recommendations?
That's a great question.
Denise Brinley was on the task force, too, representing the State Department of Community and Economic Development.
I think that, as you know, that report was very dense and it contained a lot of information.
But much of her job is focused on trying to get Marcellus Shale resources to be used within the state. And she says right now, most of the products are leaving Pennsylvania's borders. Meanwhile, others see the state's role as basically getting out of the way.
If these pipelines don't go forward, that all the prosperity that the gas resource can bring to Pennsylvania is delayed or stopped.
That's Representative John Marr, a Republican from Allegheny County. He wasn't on the task force, but he chairs the House Environmental Resources and Energy Committee. He says he's pleased with Patrick McDonnell, who replaced Quigley as DEP head. In the past few weeks, the agency's issued permits for two major pipelines. Marr's hopeful that will continue, but he worries rank-and-file staff could slow things down.
Sometimes the sailors on the ship don't care much what the captain thinks, and we'll see in this case whether the sailors are paying attention to the captain or not.
For his part, as captain or acting DEP secretary, Patrick McDonnell says the agency is addressing the task force's recommendations. He says an internal working group is handling it and points to a new web portal they created to be a hub of information on pipelines.
Pushing out some more on the public participation front has been a biggie. And there were a number of recommendations within that regard in particular.
Indeed, one of the few things the whole task force agreed on was that pipeline projects need better public relations. And how well is that going? It's debatable. Just ask Robin McGuire. She's part of a group in Lancaster County that opposes the Atlantic Sunrise gas pipeline. The project was recently approved by federal regulators. The group has started an encampment and plans to engage in nonviolent direct action to disrupt construction.
We have people from Standing Rock in. We're finalizing plans. We're going to make some noise. They're going to pay attention to us.
Meanwhile, gas industry representatives who served on the task force say they found it to be a frustrating and unwieldy process, and they don't expect much to come of it. Marie Cusick, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
As more and more planets are being discovered, it's not a bad idea to come to a court on answering this question. What's a planet? Joining me with his finger on the Funk and Wagnalls is Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Though, Derek, I don't think we're talking about a standard definition here.
Oh, no. We're sort of veering away from a standard definition, in fact. You know, when we've talked about how we define planets, it's revolved around the motion, if you will, of the now known as king of the dwarf planets, Pluto. You know, we've learned that Pluto was not part of the original number of planets in the solar system, and that there were many more, and dynamics down through the history of the early history of the solar system left us with what we have of the eight planets that we know of, and Pluto that we thought of as the ninth for quite some time. It's still in orbit around the sun, which was one of the criteria that was used to define planets by the International Astronomical Union. So a group of planetary scientists got together recently under the direction of a final year graduate student at Johns Hopkins University, Kirby Runyon, who, working with a group of astronomers across the United States, came up with what they feel is a better definition for these objects we find in solar systems that aren't stars. Let me read what their description is for you. A planet is a substellar mass body that has never undergone nuclear fusion and that has sufficient self-gravitation to assume a spheroidal shape adequately described by a triaxial ellipsoid regardless of its orbital parameters.
So it's round.
So it's round, yes. It has enough mass to pull itself into a sphere. And so that means that almost any other object in a solar system other than the star can be identified as planets. The new description, though, has eliminated some factors like the necessity for the object to have cleared its orbit of all kinds of other debris. Well, we find that that's kind of difficult to consider when we look at things like the rings of Saturn, or if we look at how so many other objects in the solar system flying through the solar system get caught in the gravitational pull of an object and then fall into that orbital path.
Nine planets when Pluto was part of the family, now eight. With this new definition, how many planets are we talking about?
Oh, my goodness. We've now blown up the number of objects in our solar system that could be considered to be planets up to 110, up to 110 objects. But remember, this includes the planets themselves, their moons, and some of the objects that we see orbiting the sun out beyond the orbit of Pluto, you know, those dwarf objects that we have described before. And, of course, that number can go up as we continue to identify more dwarf objects orbiting the sun that we simply haven't seen yet, not to leave out the recently identified presence of what's being called Planet Nine.
Though, again, this is a proposal, and the International Astronomy Union will not likely entertain this notion.
The proposers of this are not planning to bring it to International Astronomical Union for their blessing. Their feeling is that this definition is much more user-friendly, much more education-friendly. This definition at least allows us to more broadly identify what an object is, no matter where it is in the galaxy. Is it here at our sun? Is it at a sun somewhere else? Is it round in shape? Does it fit all the real criteria that helps planetary geologists, those that really know what a planet should be, does it help them identify what these objects are elsewhere in the galaxy?
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight. In honor of Black History Month, WHYY is partnering with the Philadelphia Inquirer, the Philadelphia Daily News, and Philly.com to collect stories on the theme of Black Joy. Sonia Gallagher is Operations Director of Urban Creators. It's a community farming initiative. She shared her thoughts about finding joy in her biracial identity.
I think that Black joy has to have Black preceding joy, because Black people are not afforded the spaces to celebrate themselves in the culture that we live in today. I think we are responsible for creating those spaces because we're not afforded those spaces organically or inorganically, rather, through systems of oppression and institutionalized racism, subtle or not. I grew up in both Okinawa, Japan, and the D.C. area in Maryland, and I moved to Philly in 2010 for college. Being multiracial comes with its own experiences. I'm not only multiracial, but I grew up internationally. So my lens as a multiracial Black woman is also from the perspective of Japanese context. To my Japanese family, I'm American. I'm Black. To my Black family in America, I'm Japanese. And so there's kind of this, what I call a chronic minority syndrome happening. But it does give me a chance to appreciate both sides from both contexts. I might not always feel like a part of the community directly because of that multiracial element, but it also means I can belong anywhere, depending on the perspective I choose to take. Honestly, I think joy shines brightest in the context of some suffering and some struggle. Struggling with my identity has brought me to a place of the maximum joy of my identity, you know, having to navigate social situations in Black communities, in Japanese communities, in white communities has really forced me to learn about myself and really know who I am. So Black joy for me comes from being really sure about myself.
Join WHYY tomorrow night for Black History Untold, Black Joy. For information and tickets, go to WHYY.org/events, and you can join the conversation with the hashtag Black History Untold. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyako, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.